your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to a new episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Thursday night, June 5th, 2025, as we record this new episode. And this could be a two-hour podcast, but we'll try our best to keep it under an hour. Lots to discuss for the Chicago White Sox. Big news day on June 5th. They fought to a series split against the Detroit Tigers. They had an honest chance of winning the series as they played in back-to-back one-run games against the Tigers. Now with a 20-43 record, the White Sox host the Kansas City Royals this weekend for a three-game series that will feature recent call-up for the Royals, Jack Caglione. Knowing what we know about the White Sox first base and power bat situation, any instant regrets for the White Sox passing on Cags? Speaking of first base, we'll talk about Andrew Vaughn, but in a different light than usual. If you are like me, Reddit is great in finding answers for how to do in home improvement or tech support. Well, recently on White Sox Reddit, there's a player development plan in helping Andrew Vaughn to get back on track. Then there's the surprise call-up of top position player prospect for the White Sox, Kyle Teal, as he'll be part of the rookie showcase this weekend, along with Caglione for the Royals, and of course, Chase Mydroth and Edgar Caro with the White Sox. Luis Robert Jr. hurt himself during batting practice. Yeah, lots to discuss. But the most impactful news for the Chicago White Sox came an hour before first pitch on Thursday. Jerry Reinsdorf and Justin Ishbia came to an agreement that could start the transition of power of the Chicago White Sox as soon as 2029, and for sure will transition to Ishbia's control no later than 2034. This announcement comes after two big updates this week that involve the White Sox. The Chicago Fire announcement of a new privately financed stadium at Project 78. That was the location the White Sox were hoping to work with Related Midwest and get state funding to move there. And Chicago Sports Network finally being added to Comcast. So let's get started. Joining me is Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And gentlemen, hello. James, welcome back. You were at the stadium when the press release came out. What was the reaction to the news that Jerry Reinsdorf and Justin Ishbia came to an agreement with a transition of power?
I think it's most annoying reaction in sports media, which is everyone saying, "Look, well, you kind of knew this was coming. Now this is more official now," or, "Oh, this is the direction it was headed." If you were really paying attention, and obviously a lot of credit would go to like John Greenberg and Dan Hayes for kind of reporting like the direction the thing we're heading and thus setting that expectation alongside of it. Now this deal becoming official feels like a confirmation for them. So that's part of it as well. But, you know, I think, you know, the way it got put to me like earlier in the year was like, yeah, this is like seemingly the direction sales wise it's going, but that Jerry wants to run the team until he can't, essentially, in terms of like, you know, not up to it, or, you know, he literally passes away. And I think this kind of is them formalizing and putting the timeline to that wish of what's like a reasonable timeline. Let's put it that way and leave it at that. So I think it fits along with what people have been saying about what his wishes are. It's a level of clarity and formalization where, you know, it all doesn't really mean anything until it's really done. And that's a different level of like confirmation, like, wow, this regime is actually going to end. We're actually going to see a different form of White Sox than any of us have known in our lifetime at some point, which, you know, is understandably a lot to wrap your arms around.
It is, since Jerry Reinsdorf has owned the team since 1981. I was born in 1984. So to James's point, yeah, Jerry Reinsdorf is the only White Sox owner that I, as a fan and covering the team, have ever had to experience. In a statement released to The Athletic, Justin Ishbia told The Athletic, quote, "An investment in the future of the Chicago White Sox, and I'm excited for the opportunity to deepen my commitment to the city and the team. I love Chicago, have always loved baseball, and thrilled to marry two of my passions. I'm also very pleased to have my brother Matt." Side note, Matt is the primary owner of the Phoenix Suns. and Father Jeff joining me in this investment, bringing their collective business and sports acumen to the partnership, end quote. The most interesting part of the White Sox press release is this following statement. As part of the agreement, Ishbia will make capital infusions into the White Sox as a limited partner in 2025 and 2026 that will be used to pay down existing debt and support ongoing team operations. Now, the good news for the White Sox is that part of the revenue mess, the Chicago Sports Network, will finally be on Comcast. The current over-the-air and direct-to-consumer app model isn't sustainable when all three teams, the Blackhawks, Bulls, and White Sox, are not very good nor very interesting to a majority of fans. So revenue is going to be a big focus when covering the White Sox the next couple of years because we know it directly impacts the type of player payroll the White Sox will carry, impacts what they could do in free agency, and also ultimately decide which players they could trade for, which players they have to trade away. We had this podcast not that long ago back in April with CNBC's Michael Zanian, where he shared his MLB revenue estimates. In the last 3 years, the revenues have been stagnant for the White Sox, hovering around $275 million. That was with a very lucrative NBC Sports local TV deal that was generating around $70 million a year. The White Sox don't have that TV revenue right now. And making things worse, the White Sox this season are averaging 15,914 fans per home game. That's on pace for 1.29 million fans at Wrigley Field. The White Sox last year drew an average of 17,931 fans. So they have some catching up to do this summer. Jim, paying down existing debt has me concerned from a business perspective. For an owner, as long as we have covered the White Sox, Jim, that's been steadfast about being fiscally responsible and not outspending the White Sox means, I have two questions that will never get answers to, Jim. How much debt do the White Sox have? And without Ishbia's help, will Chris Getz always have to work with an $80 million payroll because fans are not going and you don't have that sweet, sweet local TV money? Now that Ishbia is providing capital, do you have more confidence that, Jim, that money could be spent soon for the White Sox?
Well, when it comes to the debt number, when you look at Forbes' list of team valuations, they're 11th in their debt-to-value percentage. So there are a lot of teams carry some debt. Some teams are really in dire straits, like the Marlins are one where just like there are, you know, really tangled. It's really a mess. Even the Nationals have had problems. So like when it comes to the White Sox, while it's surprising that they have some debt, given that they don't pay for the stadium and that they don't spend a whole lot of money on, you know, the payroll or anything like that, it would seem like for them to have any measure of debt that requires reference in a press release is like a little bit troubling. But yeah, as you mentioned with the TV deal and such, like they are perhaps working through some stuff. It's kind of like a midlife crisis of sorts or late stage crisis for the White Sox in terms of just, you know, where they're at and where they're trying to be. So yeah, I think the biggest value of this release is that there's just some knowledge of it. Like James said, everybody gets what they want, at least a little bit. Of course, in true White Sox fashion, fans can't be entirely happy. There's always like a string attached. Everything is way more convoluted than it has to be. I was surprised when the release came out just because I was expecting the Comcast news to be the release. So I glanced at my notification, saw like White Sox announced, like, oh, okay, it's clearly about the Comcast deal. And then like I clicked, it's like, oh, nope, that's not it at all. So, you know, that was the surprise. But in terms of like, it didn't make sense for Ishbia to be gobbling up all these minority shares and have no say in like the stadium, no say in the network, no say in the things that could be affecting the franchise in the valuation, you know, the pretty fair valuation he's paid for those shares. Like, it'd be weird to pay $1.8 million or $1 billion or that valuation and then like have somebody just being able to devalue that. And all of a sudden, like, why'd you buy those shares at that money if you couldn't do anything with that? So it makes sense for him to be involved, especially with the stadium deal, you know, being very much a key aspect to the future of the White Sox. Makes sense for Reinsdorf to be somebody who, you know, as long as he's sound of mind and body, being able to say, I'm still running the team here, but also, you know, having these big fights on his hand with the, you know, network seems like it's more or less not solved necessarily, but it's at least reached a point where they can let it ride a little bit and see how it's going after it's on Comcast. But the, you know, no easy way to funding a ballpark the way he wants it to be funded. Certainly, you know, he's kind of out of ideas or out of idea because he really only has one idea, and that's having the city or the state foot the entire bill for it, basically. So having somebody come in with, you know, who's going to be running the team for presumably decades with a new stadium that, yeah, it seems like Ishbia should be the one to help drive that. And so he's involved. Then, like, White Sox fans can finally talk about the next era without sounding especially morbid. I think, like, that's one of the biggest challenges with running a site that hosts discussions about the White Sox is that you get into very blunt territory in terms of what it'll take for the White Sox to change. And because, you know, Reinsdorf is very set in his ways, so you can't expect an epiphany or any kind of late stage evolution in thinking to where, like, he's going to do something drastically different than something he's done for the last 40 years. So there's only been one assumption, and that's, like, you know, as soon as he doesn't own the team anymore. And so that gets into very callous territory about, you know, what it would take for him to not own the team. And so, like, it's very, it goes from being straightforward to being very kind of almost cruel in a blink of an eye if you don't keep on top of those descriptions. So, you know, having this 2029 date or 2034 date, you know, at least you can start talking about it in a way that's not especially mean. So I'm happy for that.
Yeah, the two questions that I'm hoping the White Sox can answer with this type of partnership now. One, who is going to be negotiating with the Illinois Sports Facility Authority if the White Sox need to extend the existing lease just maybe 3 to 5 more years until they figure out a more permanent home solution? Because after the 2029 season, the White Sox don't have a lease agreement, so they could be homeless. Two, is Justin Ishbia going to be participating in the collective bargaining agreement negotiations leading up to the 2027 offseason? So in the fall, winter of 2026, since that CBA could really impact what he can do.
To Jim's observation about the evaluation being fair, I do recall that, like, when the story first broke and you're, like, reaching out to Sox people for, like, insight on it, they were like, I think one thing to point out was that evaluation, right? It was pretty good. Like, was a kind of comments, repeated sentiment. So, yeah.
More than the Twins.
How about that evaluation? Yeah, I mean,
more than the Twins were valued for. So it's a case of, like, nice. Relative to the other team we know about, it seems in line with what they could command.
The Sox really do care a lot about winning the AL Central.
Well, there's a lot to discuss, and we need more certainty as far as how this partnership will work as the White Sox. Again, the five-year future is murky. We don't know where they're going to be playing. We don't know what future player payrolls are going to be. When we had Rebuild 2.0 in 2019, Rick Hahn said the money will be spent, Jim. And he did. They spent that money poorly, but they spent it in 2021 and 2022. Maybe they did outspend their means building a super bullpen, and now they're paying for the price.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Andrew Benintendi is, he's the debt service. That'd be a, that's just what they regarded him as, like, you're the reason why that we can't plug this money directly into payroll. But yeah, it's the Ishbia quote that Greenberg got, I think, is nice. You know, I think it's terms of, like, the idea of him buying the team, and yeah, we'll see what happens when it comes to negotiating and how much his attitude in terms of, you know, if he has the attitude that Joe Mansueto has with the fire, in that I'll pay for the construction because this benefits me. You know, that doesn't, it doesn't pay for all the construction, doesn't pay for the infrastructure, but in terms of, you know, it seems like covering half of it, roughly. Seems like, the total cost of it is still, I think Reinsdorf has floated a willingness to pay upwards of 10% for construction, which I think is vastly different. But him saying that, he wants to strengthen his ties to Chicago, like it strikes me as like the idea of buying this team, if you're somebody with Ishbia's pockets and not willing to do a deal with the Twins just to get a team that's pretty sound in terms of where they are, the fan base, the region, the stadium, like all seems like a good, solid investment if you want a team, and just happy with any team, happy to be in the cartel. The White Sox, I think, are a, they're the buy lowest of assets in terms of how little Reinsdorf has done to capitalize them being in Chicago. And the thought exercise I always go to is if you put the Guardian success in the White Sox, at 35th and Shields, they're drawing 2.5 million a year, probably something like that. If you put the White Sox success in Cleveland, everybody's thinking they're going to leave. Like they're going to draw what, 800,000, like the 700,000, based on what they drew when they were tanking, and then what little they've been able to do because they haven't won a World Series. Like they're lucky to get to 2 million with like four division titles in a row. So with that in mind, like if you're Ishbia and you have the money, like they've been doing this all wrong. All you need is a stadium, and if you pay for X amount, you'll get your money back, and all you gotta do is you'll hit this ticket amount, or there are a whole lot of ways, I think, just to capitalize on the latent value that has never really been realized since the White Sox can't make the postseason 2 years in a row via conventional means. And so I'm hoping he means what he means, but I don't think, for Ishbia it makes sense to relocate the team if you have ties to Chicago and you can actually pay what you need to pay to get this team situated in a way that's going to make money for him.
Yeah, we may not get more additional insight into this offseason when the season concludes, leading up to the GM meetings, leading up to the winter meetings, if Chris Getz can drop any hints on what the player payroll is going to look like going into the 2026 season, if the White Sox are ready to maybe push the envelope and try to be better than they were in 2025 by spending a little bit more in free agency, one could only hope.
Probably be asking him Friday.
You could ask him on Friday. Yes, I cannot wait for him to deflect your question about what went down on Thursday, James. I'm sure he'll be well prepared. For the Detroit Tigers series, the White Sox, this is a good split. And as I mentioned in the intro, they had a chance of winning this series as they played in back-to-back one-run games. On Wednesday night, the White Sox were down early 4-0, but they were able to come back and tie the game, but they lost that late. And then on Thursday, thanks to Tim Elko's walk-off hit in extra innings, the White Sox were able to split the series. James, how did White Sox manager Will Venable feel about his team's performance against the Tigers, who came into the series with Major League Baseball's best record?
I mean, it's hard to discern a difference from like his general positivity about the team, but certainly sounded pleased. If anything, was like, it was a little bit of weird presser because everyone was kind of waiting for people to try to ask him stuff about ownership. And he had a pretty like deflective, like, I wasn't focused on that answer, but it just there was a long like rain delay Wednesday night. He's just had a couple of like back-to-back pressers where it seemed like there was a lot going on that day, and he was ready to go to bed more than like raving about how good they were. But yeah, obviously, I think they look at it as they certainly got asked many questions about it, but that they hung with like the team with the best record in baseball. That's good for them, and that certainly they were in the last three games. I think when you get blown out the first one, you only get to complain too much about the luck and toss-up ones that follow. But I think they generally have spoken well about one, just like the general approach level they have on offense, and the things they're trying to execute with defense, or at least their defensive culture, which obviously kind of looks they speak of more highly than the results would suggest right now. But I think the pitching has felt pretty good about what they've been doing all year. Like even the bullpen struggles, you're not really like dealing with guys who are like established leading closers or setup guys who are like, my numbers just don't look right. I think it's more like, we've had some tough results, but like starting to throw the ball the way you want to. Like, I think Leisure probably feels better stuff wise what he's done over the last month than, his numbers would suggest. And I think you could kind of go with a couple of guys like that. Like, Icer got roughed up in the early parts of the season, but probably feels pretty good about how he's thrown the last couple of weeks. So I think, in kind with like no one being too devastated about being on a 41 and 121 team last year because they're all just kind of hanging in the majors. Now it's like no one being too bad about like a team that's already 20 games under in June because like, oh, we kind of see some improvement here in patches. And like it's all like for them, they're kind of on their expectation levels a little bit, if not in record.
Jim, do you feel better about this White Sox team after our last podcast episode, which we were lamenting about just how bad the offense looked against Baltimore?
I think Detroit opened the door a little bit. They pushed Skubal back. So they invited an opportunity for the White Sox to get back in the series by saying we can get an extra bullpen game in. And all it took is seizing a bullpen game and then being surprisingly tough against Casey Mize, having that kind of approach, which they've shown at times. They've shown the ability to make pitchers work, leaving the bases loaded a couple of times. It's classic White Sox in terms of building something but not being able to finish it off. And if they lost the game, you'd be looking at those first two innings and say, oh, they should have won this one going away. And that's the White Sox butting their heads up against the ceiling of their talent by starting things they can't finish. And then just kind of sing that same sad old song, but like they've won enough blowout games to where occasionally it works, even against better pitchers. And so, I think probably the, when it comes to the whole idea of are the White Sox truly better because, they have been able to build some cushion between this year's record and last year's record because the White Sox were in the middle of a 14 game losing streak at this point last year. So even winning like four or five games during the stretch puts them ahead. But if it feels different, I think it's because you're seeing like a consistency in what they do well and like an identity in the sense that you have some guys who can work counts. They have some ability to keep the line moving. Unfortunately, it's kind of like a game of hot potato to where, that like oftentimes it gets the person who can't get the job done versus somebody who, delivers the ultimate payoff. But you see at least a consistent quality of the team, along with a pretty surprising steady performance from the starting rotation to where, oh, here are a couple things this team does well. And occasionally pays off in a game they win by 7 runs, and you go home from the park happy or turn off the TV saying that was a good use of 2.5 hours. And so I think that's, this ability to bounce back and keep showing things that are at least bankable to a certain degree, I think, are what keeps this team separate from last year's mess.
Offensively, I mean, Mike Tauchman continues to hit for the White Sox. Chase Meidroth had a very strong series against Detroit. James, have the White Sox found their ideal top of the order with Mike Tauchman and Chase Meidroth?
Why not? I'm not sure they're in the right order of recent with Tauchman going first. I think we kind of talked to him the other day about it at length, but he's been driving the ball to the pull side almost exclusively a little bit the start of the season, kind of completely flipping his spray chart from last year. And he kind of talked about the reasons that went into it. Mostly seemed to be like being a good hitter, but he's Chase like. On top of just like his approach not being power oriented, he's not like one, he's just not like a pure burner, but he's also like, he's been pretty active on the base pass, but like you'll see him get hits and he's not like he kind of is giving it like that's a single out of the box maybe a bit more than he was early on. So you wonder if like the ankle is still a factor or just like he's generally trying to manage his effort a little bit as someone just playing every day. But like he's just not an extra base threat. For whatever reason. And I don't think it's ever going to be a big part of his game. And, he runs well enough at least to be more active on the base pass. And you're probably going to be with Tauchman, who even having decent speed has, pulled his hamstring twice this year. And you're probably not going to unleash him a ton on in that front. Traditionally, you see those profiles, kind of flip-flopped with the idea of like putting the power guy behind the kind of speedy contact on pure on base guy. Maybe you think with Tauchman, one, having a bit more extra base pop, he can put himself on second on his own sometimes, and Chase is almost without fail going to put the ball in play. Tauchman, it's a little bit more swing and miss to him. So there's some logic to it. But, like, yeah, I think they're kind of clearly your two best on base guys. And, you know, you don't have to worry about stacking for platoon reasons either. If anything, an interesting reason, like, especially if you got going again, and then there's another question about how Kyle Teal will fit. But it was interesting what they did today because they had Edgar Caro. So they kind of had, like, especially when Mize was struggling, you know, then Andrew Panattendi wound up working a full count too. And then it was like, all right, maybe this is more about Mize than anything else. But, like, that's a really, like, those are a lot of plate appearances, those top three that were going to be like even a 1-2-3 inning, you're going to throw 15 pitches type of situation. So does it make sense to distribute those guys a bit more evenly, or to just really like have a pepper grinder for first inning for their opposing pitchers every single time? We'll see. Maybe if Teal is just hitting the crap out of the ball, that kind of solves itself. A functional Luis Robert would be great to sprinkle in. I don't know if anything is really that permanent in the White Sox world, but it certainly looked interesting on Thursday when it was all working.
Tim Elko had the walk-off hit, Jim, in extra innings. He's back because Lenine Sosa is now on the injured list. Miguel Vargas is going to play more third base. Josh Rojas is going to bounce around in the infield with Elko manning first base. So this is Tim Elko part two, Jim. Does he get more run than he did in part one?
Seems like he could, especially, you know, with the walk-off, that kind of helps your case a little bit. But I think, to me, this opportunity is more about like a good opportunity to get Josh Rojas on track or evaluate him. He had a 3-hit game, so that certainly helps when it comes to resuscitating his numbers, because he's still batting 175 after it. And because of the delayed start to a season and the broken toe, there's a chance that he's already passed his peak value to the team. Like, to me, when they sign him, it's like, oh, you have somebody who can cover multiple infield positions in April while you're figuring out what third base and second base are. And then, you know, Miguel Vargas looks great and Chase Meidroff looks great. And all of a sudden, you know, by the time Rojas is healthy, it's like, okay, well, you know, we'll see what we can do with you. We weren't envisioning this. So you're going to be playing left field suddenly for a little bit because we have more infielders. And then, you know, when Sosa's leading the team in hits, like, all of a sudden it felt like the window for Rojas to be like his best self had closed. And now he's just there kind of extraneous. So with Sosa out, I think it's like a good 10-day period, and didn't sound like Sosa's going to miss too much more. But for him to establish what he was going to mean to this team, and then go from there in terms of if he is able to be the professional, you know, another on base guy who can work some walks and make righties pay, and then playing, you know, I think the glove has been sketchier than his plate approach when it comes to just, you know, what you thought you're going to get from him. Then I think, you know, when the time Sosa comes back, then it's a matter of, okay, what's our best infield defensively, offensively? Do we need to put up with Sosa's brain farts, or, you know, how are we going to start stacking wins? So I think Elko is more or less a secondary player. You know, it's funny, he had the game-winning hit, but he also struck out three times and had some of his gnarly whiffs that make you think like, oh, he's out of control. He's looking to, you know, just run into something because he doesn't exactly know what's coming yet, or is just everything looks good to him in this mode now. But fortunately, he got a hanger. You got a worse version of the same pitch, which I think always benefits somebody like Elko, is when you swing at a good curve and then swing at a bad one. It benefits him, and he took advantage of it. And with his homers that he's hit early, like, he's taken advantage of those mistakes, which I think is crucial for him to be a viable, you know, big leaguer, even if it's like a second division player. But, you know, if you're looking for a supporting effort, a complimentary player, guy who helps get outs, if you have, you know, Elko at first, that's not bad. But if you have Rojas at second, that's not bad. So I think there are multiple options, and I think it's going to be more about platoons and handedness versus trying to develop Elko, because the window seems pretty small.
And then finally, on the starting pitching front for the Chicago White Sox, Jonathan Cannon, he got lit up in that first game. And it doesn't seem right physically for Cannon. He is going to the injured list. So, James, the starting rotation, what does this look like for the White Sox for the next couple of weeks?
Well, they're certainly kicking it as far down the road as they possibly can with doing the bullpen day that allows them to basically push it until the road trip where they have to make any decision. And then at that point, if they wanted to, there's an off day and they could skip the empty spot in the rotation. Talking to Cannon just a little bit after the game today, he said, like, he kind of backed up the idea that they don't have a timeline because it isn't really set until he starts throwing. But also that, like, he's thinking this weekend there'll be like another assessment coming where they'll figure it out, but he doesn't seem too dire about it. And obviously I think if he starts throwing next week, that probably puts him in not needing more than like one rehab appearance or something like that. If it even came to that, and obviously they could sim it as well if they wanted to, but, they called up Owen White, which they immediately said is going to be a bulk option. Like Venable pointed out multiple times, like he has been starting. They also stretched Mike Vass a little bit longer than he had at any point either. And they certainly didn't dismiss the idea that he could fill in. They could certainly kind of bulk it one or two turns through the rotation and get their way to Cannon with some combination of White, Vassell, and peripherals are still decent, believe it or not, Jared Schuster. So I think they're kind of putting it off. I'd be a little surprised if they really skipped a full turn in the rotation because they're trying to give days off to guys like Burke and even Martin, pretty much anyone in their rotation. Shane Smith, certainly. So I think the only guy who like really has a track record of like doing a full season before, like, kind of hasn't done it in a while because he's been bad and bouncing around, and Adrian Hauser. So I'd be a little surprised that they're super aggressive, but it seems like because they don't have like a full starter to just call it from AAA and install, like they're going to like see how many quarters are in their pocket and like put them together and it'll equal a dollar. You could probably get there if Owen White has any kind of pocket of hitters that he could be trusted with.
One notable absence in the last three games of the Detroit Tigers series was Luis Robert Jr. After another 0-for batting line with a strikeout against Detroit on Monday night, Robert's season slash line is now a 177 batting average with a .266 on base percentage and slugging just .286. That's a .552 OPS. And Robert is 1-for-20 in his last seven games played with 10 strikeouts. So the White Sox plan was to give Robert a mental rest compared to the phantom IL stint that we talked about in our previous podcast episode. Here's what White Sox manager Will Venable had to say on Tuesday about giving Robert a break.
He's continued to work really hard here on making adjustments to get right. And, as he continues to do that, similar to Vargas earlier in the year, where he's really taking on some real adjustments, just not having him do that with also dealing with the results of the game. So I just think that, today and tomorrow we give Louis the day off and not be in the starting lineup. He'll be available, but not in the starting lineup, just to give him an opportunity to really dial in some of these adjustments without just feeling the pressure of having to go out there and perform. So he's in a good spot physically, and I just want to give him a couple days here.
Then in the most White Sox way possible, when Robert was supposed to play on Thursday afternoon, he got hurt in the batting cage.
He was in the cage yesterday and was hitting, and a ball actually ricocheted and hit him in the head. So just give him, just as a precaution, just one extra day. He'll be fine back in there tomorrow. Yeah, it was a good blow, and but he's fine, no concussion, and again, we'll be in there tomorrow.
Maybe if Robert's season turns around, we can all point to getting hit in the head during batting practice as the catalyst, but as someone who has dealt with multiple concussions, I seriously doubt that will be the case. But Venable is expecting Robert to play this weekend, as he's been keeping the White Sox center fielder busy these last 2 days.
You know, he's been around. There's been stuff that he's been asked to do also that he wants to do. And again, this these last couple of days have been extremely productive where, you know, really throughout the day, you know, he's got things scheduled that he's doing. So it's not kind of just hit in the cage and hang out. He's been working this entire time.
Venable was then asked if the mental reset will work for Robert and get him back on track.
Yeah, you know, you'd have to ask him, but for me, you know, for anybody to you know, make adjustments in this game is really hard, and separately to perform and deal with the pressure of performing is also really hard, and doing them at the same time is really challenging. So I think it's to his benefit for sure to just be able to work on this stuff without, you know, going out there and playing just for a short period of time here. And again, you know, plan was for him to be in there today, and you know, we'll get him back in there tomorrow.
I have found Reddit to be extremely helpful when searching for how to do answers. Why did my garbage disposal suddenly stop working? Reddit helped me figure out how to clean out the jam and restart the device. Why did the audio in my smartphone suddenly go haywire? Reddit helped me boot up the developer mode and fix that issue. I'm sure you have some stories about how Reddit has helped you. And recently on the White Sox subreddit page, Nick Bledsoe put together a development plan for Andrew Vaughn. You know, just in case if Vaughn is like many of us that search on Reddit for how to do answers. Vaughn is doing all right in Charlotte. In 7 games, Vaughn has a 792 OPS with 1 home run and 6 RBIs. But if he wants to be on the White Sox again, meaningful development and adjustments are needed to restore confidence for Chris Getz and the rest of the White Sox front office that Vaughn merits at bats. Reddit user Nick Bledsoe may have a plan to help Andrew Vaughn as he posted a player development plan on White Sox Reddit, and he joins us now on the Sox Machine podcast. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Josh. Happy to be here. Excited to talk Andrew Vaughn.
Yeah, so your player development plan, this isn't some long comment that you posted on Reddit. It's an official document with a table of contents and plenty of visuals to back up your ideas. Why did you put this much effort into a development plan for Andrew Vaughn?
Yeah, I really started with trying to answer the question of, you know, what's gone wrong. And then from there, I really did my best to try to make it look professional and tried to make it in the vein of something that I would imagine that you could maybe find on the floor of a front office somewhere. Just tried to make it look as credible and as fact-based as possible.
Yeah, it does look very official. Do you have a background in data analysis?
Yeah, my full-time job currently is in data analytics. So I do this kind of stuff for a living, as well as on top of that, I've played baseball all my life. I played through college, actually played right across the street from the White Sox stadium over at Illinois Tech. So lifelong White Sox fan. So it just kind of seemed to fit.
Ah, fellow D3 guy, right? Illinois Tech's D3.
Yeah.
I went to UW Oshkosh. So Oshkosh is also D3 in the WIC.
Yeah, we were in the WIAC for the first year I was there, and then we moved down to the MAC. So.
Got it. All right. So when you're looking at this player development plan, and for podcast listeners, I have this both in the podcast page and in the description as well for you to check out. If you already haven't seen this already, it's got a lot of upvotes on Reddit. Nick, I like how you identified 3 opportunities for Vaughn to get better. Really good constructive analysis, and that's swing mechanics, plate approach, and defense. Let's start with the swing mechanics. What about Vaughn's swing do you find problematic?
Yeah, I think the first thing that jumps off the page when you're checking it out is really the bat speed. I mean, I think he's in the 22nd percentile for bat speed, which for someone who's supposed to be a big power hitter, you don't really want to see that. The good thing he has going for him, though, is obviously his barrel efficiency is really good. When he is hitting the ball, he's squaring it up well, and he does barrel the ball a lot, but without the bat speed, it makes it hard for him to reach that power threshold that I think everybody was hoping he would be at, as well as his box positioning is actually super interesting. He's pretty far back in the box, which again can lead to, you know, issues in getting the full potential of his power realized. And I also think that could sort of contribute to a lot of his struggles on the outer half and on off-speed pitches.
Now, you also reference intercept point, which I think was very enlightening reading your development plan, because we've described it even on this show. The intercept point is when the hitter makes contact with the baseball, either out in front of home plate or behind the front of home plate. And Vaughn consistently, his intercept point is when the ball is pretty much hovering over the plate. He's not catching the ball out in front of home plate, which so much analysis from hitting instructors on all levels stress that if you want to hit more home runs and extra base hits, you have to have your intercept point out in front of home plate, especially the barrel of the bat. The way that he stands in the box, Nick, is that impacting, and maybe even his slower or below league average bat speed, is that impacting his intercept point?
Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of these issues sort of work in tandem with each other. I think the slower bat speed hurts him in receiving the ball deeper, but then also he's set up away from the plate and then back in the box, which also contributes to receiving the ball way further back. And like I mentioned, I think a lot of this has to do with why we're seeing so many struggles specifically on low and away off speed. I mean, it's just when you're catching the ball that far back, you're really statistically lowering your chances of barreling that kind of pitch. And then extension is a big topic that a lot of hitting instructors and people talk about. It's where a lot of power comes from. And so the farther back that ball is, you know, the less extension and the less power that he's generating.
Now, on the plate approach side, is Andrew Vaughn a lost cause when it comes to walk rate?
No, I don't think so. I mean, plate discipline can always be taught. It can always be developed. I mean, even on your own team, you see a guy like Luis Robert. He's year over year been increasing his plate discipline and his walk rates. So it's definitely possible. And I think the AAA stint is hopefully a great opportunity to sort of hone in on those things, specifically the areas of interest on the outer third, and specifically low and away are his main struggle spots. So I'd really just like to see them sort of try to take hold of that and hopefully start seeing more, a better approach to the outer half as a whole.
Now, when it comes on the defensive side, the value for Vaughn, it's probably best that he's not in the field if he's trying to looking to increase his WAR. Because again, WAR tries to take all aspects for a position player, offensively, base running, and their defensive ability, because Vaughn really struggles on the defensive side playing first base. But in your report, you mentioned that Vaughn really struggles moving to his right, but he hasn't really changed up his defensive positioning and how he plays first base. If Vaughn did position himself shaded more to his right in that hole between first and second base, do you think it could make a significant difference in how the defensive metrics view Vaughn as a first baseman?
Yeah, I think certainly it could help. I mean, it can't hurt, right? I feel like sort of from a strategic perspective, when you're having consistent issues, and the interesting thing is that his positioning has always been consistent, as well as the range issues, even going back to when they were trying to experiment with him in right field, the issue still was to his right. So there's obviously something athletically to his right. So I think any effort to try to maybe mask that would help. I'm not really sure, since it's been so consistent, it feels almost like they've intentionally put him there and just said, we'll give a little to the right to make sure that, you know, we can be on time to first base and on our left side. But certainly with the second base struggles that the White Sox have had, I don't think it could hurt to help out on that side.
So if you were part of the White Sox player development staff, and right now on that whiteboard, they are trying to figure out how to get Andrew Vaughn back on track or a better version of himself before calling him up to Chicago, what is the number one thing that he needs to address right now in AAA to get himself back to the majors?
Yeah, I think the bat speed would be, for me, what seems to be the biggest thing holding him back from unlocking that potential. And I know, obviously, walk rate is huge as well. But I think a couple of the suggestions I kind of put out sort of play into each other, just like the issues kind of play into each other. I think, you know, experimenting with something maybe like a shorter, lighter bat to help him gain more bat speed, and then maybe also making the change in positioning in the box would assist in covering the issue that could come with moving to a shorter bat. But I mean, we've already seen it this season. He's had a lot of swings. I think he's had roughly 100 swings already at 75 miles an hour this season alone. So it's in there for him to do it. It's just about doing it consistently, I think.
And so, in conclusion, with your analysis, can Andrew Vaughn be saved?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a reason he was a Golden Spikes guy. There's a reason that he hit 35 home runs in college. I mean, there's a reason he was who he was to begin with. And I think a lot of that is still in there. I think, whether it be mentality or whatever, I think it's just hard being in the environment that he's in. And so I think it's just trying to do what we can and showing the faith that he can bounce back. That would go a long way.
So what's the sequel to this report? Are you going to do one for Luis Robert? White Sox fans would love to see what your development plan would be to get Robert back on track.
Yeah, it's actually funny you mentioned that. I started working on a Luis Robert trade deadline thing yesterday. I think I'm going to try to make a case for maybe why we should hold on to him.
Oh, interesting. Do you have a revenue plan so the White Sox can make more money to afford that $20 million option?
Well, bring back the $5 tickets. I'm actually kind of upset. I saw on the promo the other day that they're doing a student pass now, and that would have been phenomenal for when I was in school. So a
Yeah.
little jealous that I missed it.
Well, Nick, this is excellent work. Again, thank you so much for sharing on Reddit. For podcast listeners, I have a link to the player development plan from Nick in the podcast page and also in the YouTube channel as well for you to check out the entire thing and read it. I highly recommend it. It's fantastic analysis. You can follow Nick on Twitter. He's at Bledsoe Nick. And Nick, thank you so much for coming on the Sox Machine podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. It's been an honor.
The Chicago White Sox stay home as the Kansas City Royals now visit. The Royals, as we are recording this, are finishing up their series against the St. Louis Cardinals. So the Royals are either going to be 33-30 or 32-31 entering this weekend. They're fourth place in the American League Central by kind of a wide margin. They were 8 games back entering Thursday of the Detroit Tigers. In their last 10 games, the Royals are 4-6. And they are below 500 on the road this year. The Royals are 13-17. Offensively, the Royals are having a very difficult time scoring runs. They are averaging 3.37 runs per game entering June 5th. That's worse than the Chicago White Sox. Their team OPS is 671. That's 26th in Major League Baseball. Their away team OPS from Kauffman Stadium is 680. It's better than they do hitting at home, but not that great. Pitching-wise, have been very good. This seems like another series the White Sox are going up against a good pitching staff. The Royals starter ERA for the season is 3.11. That's good for third in Major League Baseball. The bullpen ERA is 3.37. That's good for eighth in Major League Baseball. Run prevention has been critical for the Royals. Your pitching probables for this series on Friday night, June 6th, 6:40 p.m. Central Time. This is the night that we are hosting an impromptu Sox Machine meetup at the Remova Grill at the Remova Theater on 35th and Halsted. Shout out to Magnus, who will be visiting from Sweden. Jim will also be in town. We're going to be meeting up there around 5 o'clock. So if you got some time, stop by and say hi. Have a beer or two before we make our way to the stadium. This game is sold out. It is Mexican Heritage Night, expecting more than 40,000 fans in attendance for Seth Lugo against the dart, Davis Martin.
Davis Martin's drawing power.
Davis Martin's drawing power. On Saturday, 3:10 p.m. Central Time start, Michael Wacha against Adrian Hauser. And then on Sunday, Ray Durham Bobblehead Day, 1:10 p.m. Central Time start, Michael Lorenzen against Shane Smith. So the White Sox have three starting pitchers available this weekend. Should be pretty interesting pitching matchups for both teams, especially for offenses that have been struggling to score runs. And James Kyle Teal joins the Chicago White Sox. Why is Kyle Teal joining the White Sox now?
You're reminding me that this day has been so full, I didn't have any mental energy to commit to Ray Durham is taking train to the White Sox game for his bobblehead day. Just like, all right, there's a picture of him in front of a bunch of coffee creamers. Whatever. Gotta go, keep going. Yeah, he's been really good. He's kind of busted down the door. Like, his season stats look awesome through 50 games, and he's been even hotter than that since May. His framing numbers, at least by his telling, have gotten a lot better. He's made a kind of a crucial judgment with his glove load of recent that has got him back on track. Like, he's hitting. There's also kind of an opening in first base a little bit that he was, you know, practicing for. I think there's also an eventuality of, like, Edgar Caro and Kyle Teal are going to need to split time, figure out how to make it work there at some point. Caro kind of slowing down is a way to, like, is making him catch less. Could that be something that triggers him a little bit or helps him out or takes him off his feet a lot? But Teal's just kind of earned in a merit. It's certainly an attraction to give in front of what they're expecting to be a big crowd. And it's certainly kind of a shot in the arm to a team that it's going on a difficult road trip pretty soon. It makes you wonder, like, how soon do they think to expect to be good again if they're starting all these clocks kind of this eagerly? But Teal was going to get this at some point, and he's played for it.
And then there's the big debut for the Kansas City Royals, not off to a lightning in a bottle start. But as I mentioned, the Royals desperately need more offense, and the White Sox will get a chance to see Jack Caglione up close and personal. Knowing the struggles of Andrew Vaughn, resulting in a demotion and currently playing with the Charlotte Knights, James, will the White Sox regret not taking Caglione last year?
I think of draft picks like the similar way I think of like trades. If you get what you need or what you're seeking, if the guy that you targeted like becomes what you generally hope for, like you kind of were successful. It's if someone else lands something behind you that, you know, you were less certain about, like, sure, it's definitely a reason to, like, you know, audit yourself and process. But like, I don't think like if Hagen Smith becomes like a good number two starter that you would like, but Jack Caglione like goes to the Hall of Fame. Yeah, that's a little like sting to look back on, but I don't think it's like Hagen Smith is a bad pick. So as long as he like turns out to what they wanted, like even if it's like not happening as quickly as it is for Caglione, like certainly the White Sox aren't in a place where like, man, we really need instant impact. Damn, why didn't we go Caglione? Smith's not having a good year. I don't think I feel better about him now than I did a year ago. I know we knocked him for like a 55-50 on Fangraphs based on like how he looked in spring, but it's not a year that wouldn't fit inside like him still becoming what he's supposed to be at some point. Like pitchers have down years or times where their stuff looks bad, especially kind of guys who were kind of new to breaking out, like seeing his command or stuff back up a little bit on the track to like actually starting full time. It happens. Or even if it gets hurt, like that's kind of something that happens where like, even if it's a longer spell, Hagen Smith becomes a good pitcher. Like it's a good pick. Like the thing I always say about, I don't always say, but I'm always thinking about the James Shields trade of like James Shields was like a good number three starter and helped them like stay in the playoff race. And then was productive two more years. It's like, oh, they wound up paying way bigger cost than we thought. And that's bad. Or they kind of got sniped, but like, also, it'd be a bit more like they had a need. They filled it. Like, they paid too much, but, like, it wasn't – they didn't realize what they had to some degree, but they weren't the reason why that's, like, an all-timer trade is because, like, Shields was, like, instantly not what they needed on arrival, and that suggests, like, just no, like, evaluation on the target. Like, the same way, like, if Shields was what Shields was, but Fernando Tatis, like – flamed out like we kind of thought he was because it's ESL guy, like that still wouldn't be a good trade because you didn't fill the need you had to. So I think if you get what you're intending to, you don't have a reason to be like, oh, all-time, you know, boner. But like if Smith doesn't work out and Caglione is looking the way he's looking, which even as well as he's hitting, like valuable from a prospect standpoint, like I want to say it's a bad thing, but he's out hitting his defensive development. He's got himself to the majors like before he's probably really ready to play like major league outfield. There's going to be some wonky to this, to that maybe he'll get better and he'll just, you know, be a good out, a solid, slightly below average outfielder eventually. Maybe he's not, his outfield defense is not the reason they'll struggle or they'll succeed because it's too big, little of a factor. Or maybe because he's bad there, he winds up like ending up as a DH and that's a little bit dent on his value. But it's a little bit wonky like how quickly he's moved because he is kind of unrefined in all these ways. You know, his approach hasn't really gotten that much better. I wonder what this pace is going to do his development. Obviously, it seems like he's just too good for any of it to matter, but does he root himself in just becoming like a great DH because he made himself essential offensively so quickly that you don't get to like deal with all these things that would take a bit longer? It's obviously already made him not a two-way player anymore. You wonder what kind of how it'll do with the other parts of his game.
Yeah, Florida did not keep him in right field his junior year. They moved him over to first base with the lack of foot speed and the lack of athleticism. I think the Royals calling up Jack Aguilon is desperation, because when you are scoring fewer runs than the Chicago White Sox, but still hovering around 500, they did beat St. Louis, so they're 33-30 coming into this weekend, but you still got some ground to make up, Jim, to the Detroit Tigers. And you desperately need more offense. Easiest way to try to gain more offense is promoting guys within, and their best offensive prospect is Jack Caglione. So I think this speaks more to the Royal situation than Caglione as the prospect, Jim. But I'll pose the same question to you, knowing that the White Sox have always been seeking left-handed power. And a year ago, everyone was saying the White Sox don't need another first baseman. They got Andrew Vaughn. Now, is there instant regret?
Well, I think Andrew Vaughn was separate from the Caglione process just because his time on the South Side is limited by his arbitration process, salaries going up, White Sox payroll going down, like not going to fit. So I think that was more voicing fan frustration with, we just had the a god awful. We're in the middle of a god awful season, and the best thing they can get in the middle of the year in the draft is a first baseman, which they just keep running into over and over again. And especially with Andrew Vaughn being such a disappointment in that regard, that that's more or less like where the Vaughn connection is. Now, I think for me, the Royals are calling him up just to see how ready he is to inform their deadline plans. Like, if they went the entire 2 months, like kind of going through stopgap options, thinking, well, we can count on Jack when July arrives, and then they kind of sit on their hands a little bit, and then he shows up and he's looks completely overmatched, then that was a mistake to put all their eggs in the Caglione baskets for their offensive development. So I'm thinking of it more that they're just evaluating him. They're maybe thinking he might fail, but saying like, okay, here's what he needs to work on. This might be his timetable. Let's not be concerned about walling him off with a guy we acquire for this year, or let's count on, having him up later, but look for these positions to acquire instead. More of a fact-finding mission for them. I think, I'll give a Hagen Smith update. There's so much happened that we can't even talk about my trip to Birmingham, the show. But I did see Hagen Smith throwing. I heard he was playing catch, and then you realize that his playing catch is, kind of high intensity throwing, medium toss versus just having a catch with somebody or participating, in drills or catching somebody else who's throwing hard. Like he was, throwing, against nets and throwing, hard to teammates. So he's not out of action. He's not on the sidelines. So hopefully the elbow issue he's dealing with is more just discomfort and opportunity to try to right some things that he might have, some bad habits that he fell into. But I think if there's any regrets, for the White Sox, it might be, I'm curious whether, should Caglione become anything that they have to talk about? If they had a hitting plan in place with Ryan Fuller being aboard before that draft pick was made, would they have approached it differently versus a case of he's got some holes in his approach. We have not been able to really work with this kind of hitter. Let's work with somebody who fits more of our self-defined strengths instead in Hagen Smith. Like that's kind of maybe where I can see them saying, oh, if we knew we had Fuller, maybe we would have gone for the bats. But based on what they had, couldn't have done that. But we'll see if it's a case where, he is somebody worth regretting that much. When it comes to these freakily talented hitters who just, AAA poses no problem. I always think to Avi Garcia, just there's never a point in sending him down because he's going to hit 340 and get on base at 380 clip and strike out 25% or 20% of the time, but not in a way that ever hurt him. And so like, there's nothing for him to learn. And
He was so good there.
all of the gains were just like, they had to be realized over hundreds and thousands of plate appearances of running his head into the wall before finally unlocking the things he needed to unlock. And so there's always that possibility. I think Dan Szymborski talks about Ben Grieve in the same way, just arrived fully formed and never, you know, the rookie of the year, and then just never really improved because that's what he was. And I could see, I'm not saying Jack will be the same thing, but just more along the lines of sometimes it happens because AAA sometimes doesn't teach you what you need to be taught.
The White Sox did get Brayden Montgomery in the trade with the Boston Red Sox. To Jim's point, if they had Ryan Fuller, maybe they, and Brayden Montgomery didn't get hurt, maybe Montgomery would have went to the White Sox at pick number five, as he was highly touted going into that draft class. But it'd be fun because not only do we get to see Jack Hagione, but we also get to see Kyle Teal this weekend go up against each other. Hopefully the MLB debut for Kyle Teal is very memorable, and the White Sox continue this momentum with the homestand, especially Friday night. A sold-out crowd. It'll be one of the largest crowds for the White Sox this year at Wrigley Field. Hopefully they do put on a good show. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You could also listen and watch our videos and other podcast episodes on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine, especially on Instagram, as Jim did an excellent job taking a lot of photos and videos of his trip to Birmingham of the Rickwood Classic. You can also go to SoxMachine.com and check out a lot of the photos as far as the photo essay that Jim was able to put together from Birmingham. You can follow James on social media as well. He's at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. If you are over on Blue Sky, we kept it simple. We're at SoxMachine.com, JRFegan.SoxMachine.com, or Josh.SoxMachine.com. You can also help support Sox Machine and gain full access to all of our Chicago White Sox coverage, Major League Baseball, and the upcoming Major League Baseball draft by becoming a subscriber at SoxMachine.com. Monthly subscriptions start at $5. That gets you an ad-free version of both the podcast and website, and also unlocks the comment section for you. We also have additional tiers of support that give you additional benefits, including spots available in our Veterans Committee. If interested, go to SoxMachine.com and sign up today. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.